Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday, May 11th edition of the Joint Committee on Waste and Natural Resources Subcommittee. Yesterday we were engaged in hearing House Bill 5023, that's the Department of Fish and Wildlife's budget, and we were concluding the Fish Division overview, and I think there were some questions that needed to be and some interaction with the committee that we could pick up with. In the meantime, our committee administrator has some information that he wants to share by way of handout. So, Ken, if you want to discuss the handout.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to pass out some material provided by the department. There are some informational items at the beginning of this packet, and then there are responses to several questions that committee members have had at the back on questions on boat ramps, on the potlatch, tree farm, and on some angler license and allowable catch data that I'm going to hand out to members.
In the meantime, while that material is being passed out, I'll relay an anecdote from the weekend. I have a particular prejudice, and that is that I insist that my son's tennis shoes be under his mother's dining room table on Mother's Day, sort of something that we do as a tradition. So I had to go down to the University of Oregon and yard him out of the dorms, and we went on Saturday morning over the pass, and while we were in John Day, we stopped at the sporting goods store and bought our combination fish and hunting licenses. And so we dad shelled out $32.50 for John's hunting license, and I got mine for $32.50. We picked up the Synopsis, the fish and game publications for big game hunting and for angling. And I think there's another one out there that's just a general publication. So we're headed back over the McKenzie Pass, and I had the presence of mind to throw my fly fishing equipment in the trunk and the extra pole in a tackle box. So just about Clear Lake, which is the transit there of the McKenzie Pass, I said to John, well, John, why don't you open up the Synopsis and take a look at the trout fishing rates, because I think the seasons have been open for some time. So we spent the next 35 minutes trying to figure out what we could fish for and where on the McKenzie River. And interestingly, a trout over 20 inches is a steelhead, and steelhead are protected, and adipose clipped fish you can keep, but non-adipose clipped fish you can't keep. And a coho is a coho no matter what size it is, and the bag limit is 5 fish per day, and the keeper limit is 2 limits in your possession. But it's catch and release on natives, and after 35 minutes, we decided that it was almost too complicated to figure out what we could do, and so we did end up wetting the line at Ben and Kador's wayside there, which is about 35 minutes from the top of the pass, and that is how long it took us to figure out that we could take a chance and wet a line. So I got to tell you that Synopsis is a very complicated document to try to interpret, and I'm just wondering how many people get about 20 minutes into the thing and just slip it in the back seat and keep going. So it was hard for us to get through it. I wonder if there's not a more fisherman angler-friendly way to tell people what the bag limits and regulations actually are.
Certainly, Senator Ferrioli, that's been a concern of ours too, clearly, as many of these... Oh, for the record, I'm Douglas DeHart, Fish Division Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. As you rightly pointed out, many of these listings and new rules have brought restrictions on many different species. The restrictions have to be there. I think, as you appreciate, the challenge is how you explain that in a way that's user-friendly. The synopsis that you see, actually, with its colored maps and with its rewritten tables and the like, is a result of us bringing in an outside writer, a person who'd worked for the Oregonian for many years, to help us rewrite it in a way that was
so that
easier to write.
Right. You've identified the problem.
The problem we understand, and we've been seeking other people's advice on how to do that more effectively. We're going to look at that hard again this summer when we formulate a synopsis for next year.
Actually, I think I found a way to make my fortune, and that is to make a rubber foot ruler, you know, so that people can
make the adjustments if they need to be legal on their catches. You know, you catch a lump of trout 19 inches, you get to take it home. If it's got a foot of adipose skin, but if it's 20, it's a salmon.
It's a salmonic species and has to be returned to the water. Can you imagine the tears?
Questions for the committee? Anybody?
It strikes me that perhaps the solution to this, there's a lot of discussion in the education committee that I serve on about what we're doing in the schools today, and perhaps what we need is a class in the schools to teach us how to read the bureaucratic gibberish that goes with these documents.
Well, Simpson, I'll tell you what, I think the issue for me with species identification, you have to be very careful about what it is that you actually put in the trail. So, it's pretty interesting. Senator?
We have a solution on the sand river now.
And that is?
Yeah, well, we're trapping all the fish at Marmon and recycling them, so there are no fish up there, so you just say, why bother, and then you don't have to worry about fish.
Okay. That's a solution we've seen elsewhere. So that was just a little anecdote on the weekend, and I just wonder if part of the problem isn't just ease of understanding what angling opportunities there are. Shall we proceed with the overview?
To start off, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, you had asked for several supplemental materials yesterday. Those were information on numbers of hatch boxes in use now and historically, information on the input we provided on fiber optic routes on the seafloor, and testimony that we had offered on the groundfish rules at the February Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting, especially relative to widow rockfish. All three of those things are being tabulated now. I'll be able to get those to the chair of the committee tomorrow morning. In the case of testimony before the Pacific Fishery Management Council, we'll have copies of the minutes of that council meeting for all committee members, and then one copy of the full taped transcript. And Mr. Chair, if you want additional copies of the recorded transcript, we can also obtain those for you, but at least we're starting out with one, if that's satisfactory.
We'll make one available to any of the committee members who'd like to have access to it, and we can have additional copies of the immediate center meeting too.
To quickly finish up the discussion we were having yesterday on the marine resources portion of the Fish Division budget, the last comment I wanted to make was relative to the one increased package that is in your summary. There is a single package there proposed to be paid for with general fund dollars of just over $500,000, which would be for increased research on groundfish species and their numbers along the Oregon coast. Much of this money would go toward paying for cooperative studies on privately owned fishing vessels for both groundfish and nearshore species. I highlight this one both as a follow-up to Representative Thompson's comments on groundfish inventories, but also because it is a general fund item, understanding what a difficult time the subcommittee will have in balancing general fund issues. If there are no questions for me on the marine resources budget, I can move then into a summary of the interjurisdictional fisheries program, the fourth and final program in the Fish Division.
Further questions? Seeing none, proceed.
This fourth program area is the result of a reorganization that occurred in the last biennium when we brought together all responsibilities for working with other jurisdictions in the Columbia River and in the ocean. So this group basically does data analysis, negotiations, represents us on various agreements. Everything from co-management responsibilities on the main stem Columbia River with Indian tribes to the compact with the state of Washington, the agreements with the Northwest Power Planning Council, also the Pacific Salmon Commission, that is to say the Salmon Treaty with Canada, and the two fishery management councils on the West Coast and the Gulf of Alaska, which were established by the federal government and on which Oregon has a seat.
Question, Alistair, this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see a lot of different federal agencies. I don't see NIMS represented. Are you not involved in the negotiations with NIMS?
Representative Messerly, the National Marine Fisheries Service is a member of both the Pacific and North Pacific Fishery Management Councils. They are represented by the State Department as well as by their technical staff on the Pacific Salmon Commission. The Columbia River Compact consists only of Oregon and Washington. The tribal co-managing issues are all handled at this point under federal court jurisdiction in a case called United States versus Oregon, and the National Marine Fisheries Service is present and is formally represented by the U.S. Department of Justice on that group. So most of these groups, the National Marine Fisheries Service is a full player representative.
Fair
follow-up
question.
But when you're dealing with the Endangered Species Act, that is dealing directly with National Marine Fisheries Service, isn't it?
Representative Mentorly, that is correct. And because of the authorities of the Endangered Species Act and the requirements for consultation and specific approval, it, in many cases, those decisions from the National Marine Fisheries Service can't override decisions of these other groups that I'm identifying for you for that reason.
I still haven't heard a clear answer as to why you're not directly involved with the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Representative Messerly, we are directly involved with the National Marine Fisheries Service. Each fishery action that happens in the state of Oregon requires us to submit formal proposals to the National Marine Fisheries Service and seek their written approval. We do that.
And that is done through this department?
That is done through this group and through information and permit applications we generate in our natural production group.
I'm wondering if the flow chart needs to put a different box, because the box that I think we're addressing, Representative's question says interjurisdictional fisheries, which can indicate multiple governmental organizations as versus one to one. I'm not sure that you necessarily need a box to deal with how you're dealing with all feds other than how you deal with feds, but I would think that would be a different box on the type of
discussion. We could revise that for clarity. Certainly could be confusing to many of these other groups that I mentioned. Unless you knew what they were, you wouldn't be aware that federal agencies were members, as I understand.
You need a box going a couple pages long and see all the feds you work with.
It's a long list, yes.
Mr. Hart, relative to that, are the process you described of consultations, are the consultations timely?
Mr. Chair, because of the public review process that the National Marine Fisheries Service goes through on their Section 10 consultation, that's consultations with a state or private entity, those require several months for full processing, and we have several times been in a situation where we cannot get a timely answer from the National Fisheries Service. Often when we've gone to them, they've given us some type of interim response, and we've acted on that, but processing time is an issue for us.
And Mr. DeHart, is the processing time driven by the statutory requirements for public input at the federal level, or is it driven by lack of staff at the federal level?
Mr. Chair, I believe that it's fair to say that both of those issues arise. There is a statutory requirement for a minimum public comment time, which indeed does push this process out in time, but we've often been in a situation where we have been told that because of staffing limitations in the National Marine Fisheries Service, they won't begin to process one of our consultation documents for several months in some cases. So that occurs also.
Mr. Stehart, I would like to request from you through the director a letter detailing the delays that your agency's experienced that are attributable not to the statutory requirements for consultation for Section 10, but for the staffing
difficulties and other interface difficulties between the federal and state agencies. And the purpose for that letter would be to construct a cover letter to convey that to the congressional delegation, because we need to make sure that there are appropriate and sufficient financial resources allocated to National Interpretive Service so that consultations for all the required sessions get done in a timely manner. We're experiencing the same kinds of delays in virtually every natural resource decision area, from grazing permits and timber harvesting offering through permits for fishing and others. So I think this committee could be instrumental in helping to educate the Oregon legislative body that its congressional delegation needs to put sufficient resources in the National Fisheries Service so that they can do the consulting jobs that we require them to do and that are statutorily required of us. So if you forward some ammunition, we'll package it and fire it away at Washington, D.C.
We'll do that, Mr. Chair. We'll also ground truth that with the National Marine Fisheries Service local people, so we're correctly characterizing it. We didn't get any good information.
Oh, that's not necessary, Mr. DeArt. It's a story that's important, not the truth.
Very first question.
Before we get off this, Mr. DeArt.
Well, I was going to stay with it.
All right, but he's also detailed a program option package for ground fishing research that you may be interested in.
Oh,
didn't want to lose that tonight.
The very first question I asked the National Marine Fisheries Service when we started on the salmon plant, the first day we had National Marine Fisheries Service, that I asked them was, were you capable of keeping up with what Oregon was capable of doing in various salmon? And that was my question. And at that time, their response was yes. Now that it's been this long, I think the federal government's proved the same thing that they had with fisheries on the West Coast or not. And I'd like to say that again in case this group didn't remember that question and you weren't involved. But you're absolutely right. They seem to lose the momentum somewhere in the federal government of getting the job done. So please remind them that they did say yes to that question, the very first question they were asked.
Service Council, I think what we've got is a sort of a list and move on mentality with National Marine Fisheries Service. It's almost a hit and run situation, a drive by listing. They list the fish or list the species, and then that throws everybody into an administrative tailspin, and we try to noodle through the requirements, and we need services from federal agencies, and the bottom line is you call and nobody calls you back. And I think that's essentially a dereliction of the service duty that the National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have to administer the Act. And if you're not going to administer the Act, you shouldn't list the species. But I don't have any strong feelings about it at all. Mr. DeHart, could you recap the program option package you talked about for the research for ground fishing?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Thompson, I mentioned the general fund package that is in the governor's proposed budget to the legislature, which would allocate just over $500,000 in general fund money for increased research on groundfish species and other utilized nearshore species, including money for additional cooperative data collection on privately owned fishing vessels.
Mr. Chair, I'm involved in that, and some of the research that they're doing is really interesting. In fact, I'm just in the process of turning in for one of the department's bids. I'm going to compliment you on the programs that you're doing in that area. One of them is we're sending down undersea cameras and changing net from traditional diamond shape to a square shape, because we believe the square shape will allow more fish that are marginal size to escape. And they're going to actually put undersea cameras down to examine that, put it in the net in different locations. Things like this can make a big difference in the efficiency of the net, you know, letting small fish go. Research that hadn't been done on this coast, it has to be done species specific. There's been research of this done around the world, but each species has a different characteristics, and I commend the department for getting involved in this kind of research. It can make a difference. How well we utilize the resources.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Chair, I might highlight on the option package information relative to the interjurisdictional fisheries program. In particular, the interjurisdictional fisheries group is responsible for information collection on the lower Columbia River for the management of sturgeon and salmon species in that area, where we have both some new salmon listings, of course, but also a very successful white sturgeon sport fishery. The package that includes our increased fee proposal has several items that provide capability to this interjurisdictional fisheries group. The largest of them is for the tagging and sampling of white and green sturgeon in the lower Columbia River and in coastal estuaries. The green sturgeon in particular is a species where we have very limited information and are trying to improve our information base and population estimates as quickly as possible. There is also a package relative to interjurisdictional fisheries that will provide limited duration positions and limitation to accept federal contract dollars for sampling work as well. Those are the two packages in this area. Are there questions for me on the interjurisdictional fisheries program?
Question, President Johnson.
And I'll be generous. This is an area that we've had a lot of controversy over. If your scientific research on green sturgeon shows that there is adequate amount to be harvested, will you open that fishery up that you had made a contact with the state of Washington?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, if our survey information shows that stock status and production are adequate to support a fishery, certainly. Now, we would be hesitant to do that unilaterally. What we would do if we had the good information is sit down with the state of Washington together, and I believe if we had good information to support that, they would be willing to flex that also. I've just been in contact with the state of California also. Difficult issue for us because at this point, the only known site of green sturgeon spawning is in the middle reach of the Klamath River. That's why we want to get additional tags out, see if we can identify additional production areas and show that we're still able to produce these fish in numbers.
The state of Washington doesn't harvest green sturgeon in the ocean except for at the mouth of the Columbia River. The state of California wants to harvest them in the sport fishery, so there's only one state that will be interested in this that worries me in any ocean harvest. I think we're going to lose unless we just say this is our research. The reason why this was a very sensitive subject to me is what happens if, without the research, that they shut down the ocean fishery and with no contact with the fishermen. Since then, they tried to rectify the mistake. But if it was more a case of departmentalizing, everybody assumed that the Columbia River was where the problem was, and they never took into any consideration that there was a marine fishery on that fish, and there was a lack of communication. I hope they've resolved that lack of communication. So anything I can do in the research in that area, I'm willing to help you. There isn't really a specific question you answered mine. I encourage you to get the statistics that we need, and then reopen it if it's reasonable.
Certainly, that's our intention. In fact, Representative Thompson, an interesting idea was brought to my attention by a sturgeon expert at the University of California recently. There is some possible speculation of nearshore ocean spawning of green sturgeon. If that were to occur, that's not known in any other sturgeon species, but it would certainly put a whole different light on this issue of production and year class strength.
Also, we know very little about this fish. In fact, I believe that there's a lot more of those fish on the coast than we realize. I think they spend a lot of time in the shallows where no one can contact them until the first storms in the winter, and then they move offshore. And I've been involved in it for off and on for 20 years. In fact, produced most of those, and they're an interesting fish. I just encourage you to do as much research as possible, and then we move forward as a fishery if it's appropriate. I believe the stock is expanding rapidly.
I think good tagging information will help us define that, Representative Thompson. Mr. Chair, then if there are no further questions on interjurisdictional fisheries, there were a few areas with budget implications I wanted to highlight for you just to complete my summary. One of those is one that I believe you'll be talking about in depth within the Salmon Restoration and Stream Recovery Committee later today, and that is the use of Measure 66 dollars. As you're aware, in our budget, there are several items proposed by the governor that would carry through Oregon Plan activities in particular with Measure 66 funding, including most of the funding for our juvenile and adult salmon inventory work on the Oregon coast. That work is ongoing now, a fairly large, complex program. Committee members may have seen in the newspaper recently articles on the large mechanical traps that are floating traps that are being used in many coastal rivers now. That work, of course, would stop July 1 if there's not funding continuity to pay for those activities into the next biennium. So we're hopeful that whatever direction Measure 66 funding goes, there is some provision to maintain that funding during the early part of the biennium for ongoing activities to avoid shutting down any sampling programs and in effect losing a year's worth of information. A second problem area potentially, and that is with the habitat biologist positions that we have had in our budget with e-board action in this biennium at the request of the Oregon Forest Industries Council to provide technical expertise primarily for habitat restoration on private forest lands in the coastal watersheds in the Willamette Valley, but also on other privately owned land. The Forest Industry Council and others have been working closely with the Wildlife Heritage Foundation, and it's their intent to work closely with GWEB or its successor to secure the funding to continue that program. Our budget contains no limitation or positions for that program at this time. And then one last potential problem area to mention to you, and that's relative to Senate Bill 834, which would direct us to purchase from outside the department approximately 10% of our annual trout releases that are produced with state dollars. Our intention would be, if we move ahead with that program, to fund that through the new trout dollars that would come to us as part of our fee increase package. If the fee package is not adopted or is not adopted in something near its present form, we would not have dollars to carry out Senate Bill 834 as no funding is directly linked to that. Our only other choice would be to close other facilities to free dollars. So I wanted you to realize that the Senate Bill 834 implementation is tied to that issue and that package. Those are all the comments I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Thompson, in the area of closing other facilities, I assume you mean by closing other trout hatcheries that are colder water and not as productive as ours.
Representative Thompson, that is correct. We would close down other facilities. We would do that on a priority basis based on the level of cost effectiveness of each facility. In some of our facilities with the coldest water, we do get the coldest growth.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was reading this morning the News Times report, interesting article about the Eastern Russians that were visiting. And I'd like to ask a question about this quote. The regulations are very strong, talking about the Russians. They require a 1 mile buffer, excluding forestry and agriculture along any riparian zone. Then this quote, they didn't start off with the concept of private property, Mark Chilcott. So in terms of habitat protection, they are actually ahead of us. In other words, private property was a problem, 1 mile buffers. explained to me, if I was, based on what you said a minute ago, and I was a forest operator and agriculturalist, I think I would worry about that concept. Does that philosophy reign throughout your agency?
Senator George, of course, that isn't the philosophy of our agency. That's a description of the management regime that prevails within Russia. It is correct that on salmon spawning streams in Russia, Russian federal law sets aside actually a 1 kilometer, not 1 mile buffer, about 6/10 of a mile buffer, on each salmon spawning stream, and all activities, including forestry and agriculture, are excluded from those areas. Those laws have been very long-standing in Russia. The forestry exclusions date back to the time of the last Tsar, which is a way of saying once you put those in place, they have predated most current activities rather than caused the Russian government to come in and co-opt any existing areas. But Senator George, certainly we're not advocating a similar system here. Our record has been to work cooperatively with landowners on riparian set-asides and riparian fencing programs, which I think have been quite successful.
Let me read that one more time. They didn't start off with the concept of private property. They are actually ahead of us. Now, that indicates to me a direction. And I don't want to hear about Russia. I already know what kind of system they have. I want to hear about where are we going here.
Senator George, let me try again.
This is an employee, and I want to know where this heads.
That particular employee works for me, and I have had detailed discussions with him on this issue, so I believe I can accurately characterize what he's saying. What he is explaining is riparian protection in Russia is very good. Riparian conditions there are excellent. We're trying to produce similar excellent riparian conditions here by different means. We're making very good progress. He's commenting those were the means that were used in Russia. There's no intention either on that individual's part or on the Department of Fish and Wildlife to use similar methods here. Different parts of the world, different issues, different laws.
Socialist salmon, Mr. Chair. Socialist salmon.
Do they taste different?
They're red.
Mr. Hart, could you discuss the screening dollars in your budget, and is that coming from Emergency 66 or General Fund, or and what is the amount of dollars? I just looked through the budget and I couldn't find it, so I'm sure this is a...
Representative Metterly, there was actually in our budget proposal a was really a placeholder for a proposal to be brought forward later by the Fish Screening Task Force that was put together by the instruction of the last legislature. I believe the placeholder amount was $500,000, if I recall. But there has actually been a proposal brought forward now by the task force, which is outside of our budget, but which I understand has been made available to legislators, and I presume will be used in the discussions relative to the future of Major 66 funding. That particular proposal, as I recall from seeing it recently, identifies some dollars that could be used for consultations with private landowners and for engineering designs of passage facilities on private lands, and sets up a similar cost-sharing mechanism for private landowners for small passage facilities as that now exists in the state-supported fish screening program.
What is the total amount of that?
Representative Messerly, I can't recall the actual dollar figure off the top of my head. I can get you a copy of the package, I believe, today with no trouble, and get that to you before the end of the day.
Okay. One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is there federal funds available to enhance that program, too?
Representative Messerly, there have been some federal funds available in some areas, such as through the Mitchell Act budget in the Columbia Basin for some time, but there's now been new federal legislation passed that sets aside new federal dollars for cost-sharing from the federal side Jan Lee and others were very active in supporting that federal legislation, and that'll make new dollars available to Oregon also, and it'll help us.
Further follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Just a follow-up.
How many years have we been struggling with the fish screening program?
Representative Messerly, the current state-funded screening program has been in place now, I believe, for 6 years. The amount of cost-share funding, of course, is relatively small. It's been just under $500,000 per biennium, which has meant that our pace is not quite as fast as we would like. But we're still on a track to complete all of our high-priority screening sites within approximately 10 years, and then it'll take us a little over 20 years to complete all screening of all sites where juvenile fish are present, and we believe screens are needed to comply with state mandate.
Is that acceptable with the listings we're now dealing with?
To this point, Representative Messerly, the National Marine Fisheries Service has accepted our schedules and our criteria. I'm sure it's fair to say that they would like to see a faster pace, but they go through a formal process of jeopardy determinations, and they have not made jeopardy findings in any area based on our present screening schedule.
Thank you.
Question, Senator George.
Thank you. Commissioner Clark, I'm reading the Oregon Wild Fish Management Policy piece that was handed out to us, and it states in here that the set of rules that are basically regulating how we deal between the fish propagation and the hatchery versus natural, that these rules were adopted in 1990. Do you have the budget numbers, or can you get these for us, that indicate how we were spending the money relative to fish propagation in the 89-91 budget?
Senator George, I can certainly obtain for you, of course, a copy of our 1989-1991 biennium fish propagation budget. For comparison purposes, though, what you will see is that our fish propagation budget today is larger than it was in the 1989-1991 biennium.
Can I ask a question? Sure. In this piece, it says several times the past hatchery practices have not helped natural production. It goes on to say things like that, talking about we don't want to place the blame on former scientists that were using the best current data. Are you sure that the current data that we're using now to make the decisions about de-emphasizing the hatchery and re-emphasizing the natural is, in fact, the absolute correct way?
Senator George, it is certainly true, as you indicate, that there have been some practices in the past that fishery scientists believe have been detrimental, such as bringing fish in from a basin far away from a particular area, as one example. Am I sure that there are no current practices that continue to create problems? No, I can't assure you that. All I can assure you of is that we are using all available scientific information, and we're using the best available advice we can obtain today in carrying our program out, so it is as effective and supportive as we know how to make it. Now, on the other hand, I want to stress, we are not substantially downsizing our hatchery program at this time. As I mentioned to you in the summary of that portion of our program, we continue to produce over 75 million salmon, steelhead, and trout annually. We use different stocks now. We release them in different areas. We use different marking practices. We use many different practices in our facilities, and we reshape many of our programs. But our strategy isn't to downsize and eliminate the state hatchery system at all. It's to use it effectively.
Follow-up. From the 91 period, you indicated that we've had a substantial increase in the amount of money being expended in propagation. And here we understand from this piece that a 1990 decision was made to de-emphasize hatchery and basically work towards the natural. When you look at the total fish population of salmonoids, how are we doing in the sense of the total numbers comparing 1990-91 for natural and propagated? How do the numbers look?
because we did set a new direction. We said it in the past. That was a mistake. How are we doing now?
Senator George, I can't, of course, give you detailed numbers from memory. Generally speaking, numbers of naturally produced fish in the state have been at low levels through most of the 1990s, driven, we believe, primarily by extremely poor ocean survivals during that period of time. Our hatchery program on salmon and steelhead has also reflected those low survivals during that period. Trout production, on the other hand, has held up quite well, both wild and hatchery. The wild trout production, the natural production, driven, of course, by particularly wet years in southern and eastern Oregon, which have been favorable to those fish. Now, if we see these very strong northwest winds this spring, for instance, and we saw some improvement last summer, we're starting to see hatchery returns in particular turn around. We're expecting strong hatchery coho returns this year, the strongest probably in this decade. So we're seeing some changes in that area now, Senator Kirk.
Okay, just one quick statement. If you think about what was said there, so we have the trout population rising, we have salmon going down. The obvious conclusion, if both practices remain stable, was that the problem is really at sea. And yet the focus of this new process is on habitat and restoration of stream. Somehow in here we're going to have to deal with the reality that we need to know what's happening at sea. What's going to happen to us understanding that problem? I know this gets back to whether the feds are going to invest money in advocacy research.
Senator George, two answers to that question. One of them is we have a very extensive marking program to understand the actual survival rates of Oregon-produced salmon at sea, and have very good data on that. On this question of natural productivity at sea and the productivity of food species, this is an area, as you rightly point out, research is extremely expensive. We are unable to fund work in this area. We've encouraged the federal government to do that. Some ongoing activities have proposed work that could start as soon as next year in that area, and we'll be watching that closely. But I do have to be candid with you. This at-sea research on basic productivity, on the production of bait fish species, on the production of these small shrimp species, big ocean out there, 1 or 2 or 3 years information will be highly variable. It'll be hard to interpret it and use it for decision making. I mean, I'll welcome it when we have it, but when we put it in front of you, it'll be hard to take that and say, okay, here's the number of these little shrimp we expect next year, so here's what we ought to do. It'll be difficult to use it that way.
Should be hard to Chair will recognize Representative initially after he pontificates for another interview. The concern I think that Senator George is touching on is that the folks in the uplands and on the in the habitat management areas feel I have nowhere to hide. I mean, they're accessible, they're visible, they're subject to regulatory rules and permit dependent. And it just seems like the emphasis is on the habitat issues. And at some point in time, it seems like the net effect will be increased cost, the difficulty of operation for natural resource direction, and relatively small or marginal benefits to salmon survival. So it's a disproportional cost that we're shifting to land-based upland operators and landowners. And I just, I'm real sensitive to that because of the district that I represent and because of the costs that the Ag and Natural Resource Sector will have to absorb in consideration of the listings and the Clean Water Act issues and the ESA issues. So it's not a frivolous question. It's not a frivolous issue. It's a very important crossroads kind of question because we're asking people to incur lots of costs, lots of expense, lots of inconvenience, and asking them to go further than the Endangered Species Act would push them. We're asking them to try to be contributory to recovery. But after we've done everything that we could reasonably do in the uplands and some things that are fairly unreasonable to do and still don't have the kind of returns that we'd like to have, what then do we tell the landowner? You know, what then do we tell the folks that we're pulling into the Healthy Springs Partnership if we don't also fairly and honestly face the issue and make the investments in ocean condition research?
Mr. Chair, I certainly agree, and I myself have repeatedly argued that we need to have good evaluations tied to habitat improvements so we can demonstrate the benefit of those actions when they're carried out. I might also comment relative to the discussion we just had on the state fish hatchery system. The state fish hatchery system is also very visible, high profile, and in the crosshairs at this point on this issue, and that's why we are working so hard to be sure that we can demonstrate that that those programs are not harming wild fish production. Certainly, your constituents wouldn't want to take those expensive actions on their land and then think that because we weren't correcting problems in state fish hatcheries, we were negating that benefit either. And we take that obligation seriously and are moving ahead on it aggressively.
Okay, well, Mr. Dehar, I guess the message that I hear from you, if I could paraphrase, is that the hatchery program of the state of Oregon is not harming wild fish. I just tried to state that back to you just as I heard it.
Senator Ferrioli, we believe that the changes we have made in the operation of our program, the way we operate it now, we have addressed those issues that we believe would be harmful to wild fish species. There is a second issue, and then that is how we use those hatcheries as part of run recovery. That's the second area we're putting time, thought, effort and money into at this point. But we don't believe at this point that the operation of the state hatchery system poses a significant risk to wild fish in the state.
And I guess that I wish that message were more clearly articulated and in more general terms, because I often hear that one of the reasons for the decline is the hatchery system. President Mishra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dehar, just looking through my file, and I didn't bring it down, but I do have in my office a report that was done by your department on the hatchery program analysis, and I believe it was a draft form that I was told that it was very close to the approved form that the commission looked at as well. Two questions for you. Number one is that study compared the state fish hatchery program to the federal hatchery program on the Columbia River only. And my first question is, why did you not include in that study other types of hatchery programs such as STEP, steelheaders, private sector hatcheries for a really in-depth comparison and a more realistic, in my opinion, comparison of how your state program would measure up? Secondly, in my opinion, that was a very negative report. If I was in your position, I would have been very concerned about that. And I could almost, in my opinion, say it was a scathing report. I'd like you just to respond to that. What are the problems within the department? Why the hatcheries have those kind of problems and are just not operating at the standard that the department has set for those hatcheries?
Representative Messerly, members of the committee, the report that Representative Messerly refers to is a review that we completed this winter on the operation of coastal salmon hatcheries. We also included several Westside trout hatcheries in that review because they were the subject of budgetary actions and we wanted that information available at the same time. They looked at cost efficiency of coastal hatcheries, whether we were complying with current regulations and rules, and laid out future directions for those facilities. We had comparable information that had already been funded by the Bonneville Power Administration for salmon hatcheries on the Columbia River, so we used those as a comparison. The first of Representative Messerly's questions, as I remember, was, well, why didn't we include STEP? Why didn't we include other state hatcheries? The reason was the size of the job that we were already laying out there for existing staff and the time frame we had to finish it to make it available for use during this legislative session. We thought that would be the most critical information. Our intent is to now move ahead with similar reviews on other state-supported steelhead and trout facilities, and also on STEP and other cooperative facilities that programs that the department is involved in. I would say, though, I don't regard that report as scathing. In fact, I would say that the report demonstrates that we have largely been successful in meeting the federal requirements that are put on us and the state rules that we operate under. The report does identify a number of areas where we are not collecting information that is needed to evaluate a number of questions, and that's basically a dollar issue. It does also identify some areas where we are behind schedule in meeting some other changes in particular programs, be it the development of a new acclimation facility or other specific action, and lays out the time frame that it will take us to complete those actions. So it's a very detailed look. I think, though, a person can fairly look at it and they can say that that Oregon is trying to deal with this issue just as well as we can with our resources, and we're making good progress. That's how I interpret the report.
Any further? Any questions? Anybody? Okay. We proceed.
Well, I was going to touch a little bit on the marine part of this.
Sure, recognizes that. Okay. Thank you, Representative.
One of my questions, Nemo. Okay, I will. Kind of head. Because that is, there's the main part of it's one thing we can't get our hands around that National Marine Fisheries Service needs to spend their money on. But one of the things that always bothers me is in the area in your hatchery program, and it reflects on what Senator George talked about and the ILC. Can you produce or can you give us some information to show that hatchery production is not related to the pinniped population in that area? Can you give us some graphs? Because I question the statistics there. If since the Marine Mammal Act went in and there was virtually no pinnipeds in that area, if you could produce what the hatchery production numbers are and your recovery, and then also produce it so we can correlate those two and see if they're not direct.
Representative Thompson, we do have counts on harbor seal populations in Alfie Bay. We can provide those to you as well as magnitude of our hatchery release and return to time. Though, of course, one of the things you'll see is that harbor seal numbers are indeed up in the last decade at a time when our hatchery returns are down in that area. Of course, our hatchery returns have been down in all of the central and north coast in that area. But certainly, I can't assure you that that harbor seal predation, especially on juveniles, isn't one partial cause for that issue. We put in place a research program now in Alfie Bay to try to better answer that question. We've been collecting data now for 2 years, and we'll continue to do that there on this question of predation on juvenile salmon by harbor seal.
But could I get the year by year as the number returning percentage wise and compare that to the harbor seal?
Yes, Representative Thompson.
But one of the reasons why I'm not a member, but the Aquinas system, which is just north of there and has very few harbor seals on it, seems to have kept an adequate run of fish. And I don't want to have the heart to go to this much trouble, but I still question that in some of these ports where there are a lot of harbor seals, that may be one of the effective numbers that you've asked the landowners to go to this, take this, bite this big bullet, but you're not willing to deal with the pinniped population. So if you could just give me that one little slice and let me look at it. I've never seen those numbers parallel.
We'll do that, Representative Johnson. I might also comment quickly, as you understand, but for the benefit of the rest of the committee, harbor seals and sea lions are managed by the federal government under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The state has no management authority over these species at this point. I have given Ken Rocco, however, for distribution to you our testimony on House Joint Memorial 7. I believe Senator George asked about that a day ago, as well as our testimony on Senate Bill 988. You'll see in our testimony on Joint Memorial 7 that we have and continue to advocate that Oregon be given management responsibility over these species so that we can manage their population sizes. We've also provided information to the National Marine Fisheries Service and supported legislation that's now pending in Congress that would give National Marine Fisheries Service authority to delegate such responsibility to us. So we are aggressively seeking that authority. We don't have it at this time.
Further question of some comment, and then Senator Corson.
I'll go briefly in this area and touch on what he mentioned in marine ecosystem. We haven't, and they are not capable, the department is not capable of getting the information we need. But I do a little bit of this research, and it astounds me at the huge variability in the populations out here of these small shrimp like krill, copepod. This year, I've never seen it before in the few years that I've been doing, 10 years. The whole ocean's full of souse. It's a little jellyfish like this. It's absolutely chock-a-block full of souse. You take a fry net out here off this coast, and in 3 minutes, you've got a net that's absolutely plugged to the gills. We can't even find a lot of the small fish that we would normally find on the surface at night trawls, all full of this little jellyfish. We know so little about this area of the whole ocean turning over, and now how does south affect the ecosystem for when the small go out in the ocean? One of those unanswered questions. It's one of those questions that I hope someday we'll be able to wrestle with, but if we don't start down this line, we don't get National Marine Fisheries Service and get people thinking in this sense, we'll never get the answers we need to try to manage fisheries. Thank you for my little speech.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The senator from the People's Republic of Newburgh raised an interesting question, and that is that if, in fact, the fish population, the salmon population in Russia are benefited by the buffer zone, regardless of private property issues, which I know are dear to your heart.
Yes. I like the Constitution.
I understand, and I really appreciate that.
Point of personal privilege, Mr. Chair.
I think we're losing here.
I would like to school my good colleague from Mexico, someplace down there.
Yeah.
But there is no such word as irregardless.
Okay.
Please speak correctly when you're a guest of our committee.
Thank you. Thank you. I am so sorry, Representative Westland. Thank you so much for that. I hope you...
I'll teach you.
Yeah.
Stay close.
Anyway, my point is this. It's the same ocean for in Russia is here. And if there's two practices that are different, one being the set aside and the other being how they deal with pinnipeds, that would be very interesting information. I don't know if the department could get some information like that. But, in addition to having a different policy about the buffers, do the Russians have a different policy about pinniped control? And if that were the case, that would be a very interesting argument to make in terms of pinniped control. That just occurred to me. I mean, I was on this committee in 95, and it's deja vu all over again. Did I say that right? With Representative Thompson here. I mean, we were having the same argument about pinniped. But I never knew about the Russian connection until my socialist senator friend here brought it up. So I think that's a bear looking at.
Senators, you're going to have to spend the whole day together and later tonight about an evening
thinking about the
committee. Thinking about it. I think there's a lot more variables, and it would benefit us, I think, to look at them. I think the fisheries management is much different. I wouldn't stand on the Soviet's environmental records.
Right.
I just don't think that's one of the things you want to take as an exemplary object lesson for anybody. The buffers are
there in statute, but apparently observed mostly in the breach. The forestry practices in some of the more remote areas are non-existent. But neither has harvesting been a big feature until very recently in this latter part of the 20th century. So I guess the variable list is huge, and how that affects populations of salmon, I don't know. The other thing is I get the impression there's not as much hydroelectric power production on the spawning streams in the Soviet Union as we have in some of our streams. So a lot of different variables, and we ought to... If you're suggesting that it would be worthwhile doing a comparison, I'm sure the committee would vote to send you as an emissary to the Soviet Union.
I could get training in the People's Republic of Eugene.
We're really running out of time here. Do we know what the policy is?
Actually, I've had extensive discussions with some pinhead biologists in the Russian Far East because of our participation on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, where the Stella sea lion is listed in both U.S. waters, and actually it's listed in Russian waters on the Russian Red Book also. The answer is that they do have protection programs in the Russian Far East as well. And they are attempting to rebuild some depleted stocks, but in areas where their stocks are healthy, they do allow controlled harvest, both for native subsistence use and for commercial utilization.
I wish we would get into the issue of native subsistence use on the West Coast, because I think that would be a way to provide some equitable balance and also honor some treaty rights that we haven't even thought about.
Colleagues, I'm going to ask us to get to our sessions. We had a 9:15 session, but I will, our 9:45 session this morning for the Senate, 10 o'clock to the House. I'll remind all the members, we have a hearing today at 1 p.m. in room 50, which is a public hearing on the Department of Fish and Wildlife budget bill. So if you have, we all have other committee responsibilities, but from 1 to 4, we'll be hearing the public testimony on House Bill 5023, and that's a special session.
Just a quick announcement, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to remind all of you that the commission is holding our commission meeting here tomorrow in Salem, and tonight they're having a reception for all legislators. That's at 5:30 at the New Keynes Inn at the corner of I-5 and Market. They'll be there for the general public from 7 to 9, so you're welcome to stop by any time. Get a chance to meet the commission and ask any questions and talk about some of these budget issues we're discussing.
He is invited. And we are an adjournment.